Ruby recognized the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the steps discussed tonight. This evening, we are discussing step three. Please welcome our panel this evening. Sorry, Adam and Jen. I will read the first paragraph on the page, and then Adam and Jen will share a few minutes each on the reading. All right. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God as we understood him. On page 60, our description of the alcoholic, the chapters to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought.
My name is Adam. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
You guys hear me okay? All right. My sobriety date is November 14th of the year 2000. My home group is Shoulder to Shoulder over in Yorktown, Virginia. We meet on Thursday nights and Saturday nights at 7 p.m. The reading, pertaining to the third step, so what I heard in there was the C, you know, that God could and would if he were sought. And my experience with the third step was a very slow experience. I was slow to come to some kind of spiritual connection with a higher power. As is illustrated in the following paragraphs after that, you know, it talks about that actor that wants to control the whole show. And I was also, and still am, a recovering control freak. And I don't know if I was necessarily closed-minded to the idea of a higher power in my life as much as I was very closed-minded to the idea of giving up control of my life to something else other than myself. It wouldn't have mattered if my higher power had been sitting right next to me. I did not want to let go of certain aspects of my life. I thought I was doing a pretty good job. But when I reached that bottom, not the drinking bottom, but the control bottom, I was finally able to open my mind up to the idea that a higher power could bring about some pretty significant change in my life if I allowed it to happen. And slowly over time, that did begin to happen. And all it took was me trying to seek, you know. It wasn't that difficult. And me willing to let go of all that control that, like, I really, I don't know. The control was almost as bad as the alcohol, if I'm being really honest. It was really, really hard. I loved it, and but yeah, that's my experience. I'll pass. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Jen. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jen.
My date of sobriety is October 1st, 2012, and my home group is AA 101. We meet on Sundays at Norfolk Sentara, Norfolk General at 11. So, yeah, I'm very similar to Adam in that I recognized that I was powerless over alcohol long before I recognized that I couldn't manage my life, that my life was unmanageable. I actually shared about this on Sunday because it's been really on my mind a lot. I could tell you that once I had a drink, I didn't know what was going to happen. I knew that I was powerless. I knew that once it hit my lips, all bets were off. I feel like I'm okay. All bets were off. And you know, I didn't know where the night was going to take me. 9 times out of 10, it was bad. And the 1 out of 10 times that I ended up okay, I could never recreate the scenario that enabled me in my head, you know, in my head. Somehow I'd found the magic formula that allowed me to drink like a lady that night. But, you know, regardless of how many times I tried to recreate, it would inevitably, you know, the next time it wouldn't turn out nearly as well. And by turning out well, I mean that when I woke up, I was at home. My husband didn't quite hate me, My kids were fed, and I only had a slight hangover. I only half felt like I was going to die. So that's like a good scenario for me at the end of my drinking. That's kind of where I was. And I recognized that that was powerlessness. I knew that drinking had me, you know, but I thought that I could still manage the outside of my life. My home life was crumbling, but I still had this kind of this fenced off area of my life, this really protected space where I was a really good student and people respected me at school. And that was the part of my life that I thought, if I can just manage this, this is all me over here, and I'm doing this, and no one can tell me that I can't manage my life, because look at all this that's going on over here. Don't look at over here, because over here's bad. You know, over here, my husband's trying to leave me, and my kids, you know, or my daughter barely knows me, and all hell's going, you know, breaking loose over here. But over here, I've got it together. And I ran my life like that for a really long time. I'll tell you, I drank myself out of a PhD program not once but twice. You know, luckily they didn't ask me to leave. I said I need to leave because I thought that if I, you know, acted the part for a while and got my husband back on board and got my family to maybe like me a little bit, then things were going to be okay. But the reality of the situation was all roads lead back to me. And when I'm drinking, that means all roads lead back to chaos and unmanageability. And eventually, what happened was the stuff that was happening over here in my personal life started bleeding over to this protected area where I felt like I could manage things and I could control my appearance and my image. And ultimately, everything just crumbled. And that's when I really had to look at myself and say, I can't do this anymore. I cannot. It took 5 days hold up in a hotel room in Florida. You know, I probably remember about 5 hours of those 5 days. And that's what it took for me to realize that I'm not doing this stellar job of managing my life like I think I am. So that kind of brought me to step three. I'll pass.
Awesome. Thank you. The next reading's on page 60. Being convinced that we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our lives over to God as we understood Him, just what do we mean by that, and just what do? The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be success. On that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody. Even though our motives are good, most people try to live on self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, he is more likely to have varied traits.
When I read that first sentence, you know, well, not the first sentence, but the first sentence of the second paragraph. You know, the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Like, hardly a success for me, drinking was like more than enough to continue drinking. You know, I didn't need to be successful hardly at all. But like, if I was successful 1% of the time, I considered it like, that was pretty good, and I was comfortable with that. And again, like getting back to this idea of wanting to control everything, I wasn't just addicted to alcohol, but I was also addicted to my crappy lifestyle. And this idea that you guys were promising me this new life that was going to be so amazing, it was going to be beyond my wildest dreams, and there was going to be this fourth dimension that I was going to go to and all this stuff, like, I wasn't that comfortable with that because I didn't know what that was. And I knew what crappy life was like, and I was okay with that. I knew what to expect every day. It was very predictable. I was going to do the same thing day in, day out, same results. I knew what it was going to be. But I was scared because y'all were saying, oh, you just turn your will and your life over to the care of this thing, this entity, this higher power, a God of your understanding, you know, all these terms you all used, and your life will be, you won't even be able to imagine what's going to happen. And I'm like, no, I need to imagine it. Not only do I need to imagine it, I need to have experienced it, and I need to know exactly what's going to happen. And y'all are scaring me with these statements. But you know, like with a lot of things, with my drinking and the way I was living, even when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, the pain became great enough where I was willing to try new things. I've already touched on a lot of the control stuff, but you know, I loved trying to make arrangements. Like, that was such a fun thing to do, drinking and not drinking. I loved to try to set things up to work out perfectly for me. And I even enjoyed when they didn't, because it meant like I got to kind of troubleshoot and look at, okay, now I've got this one person that's not doing what I need them to do, and I'll get them to do it. And like I said before, it was an obsession. It was another addiction. I probably ruined a lot of relationships because of it. The last few years, I've been trying to sort of reconnect with some people from college, and I don't know to what extent I destroyed those relationships. I don't know if I just, you know, charred the bridges, or whether I, you know, blew those things up, you know. But there was a lot of that going on then, and I don't think I was a particularly great person to be around then, and my circle of friends or people that I could arrange had grown quite small towards the very end. So I don't know, you know, it's an interesting journey. It's nice to watch life happen around me nowadays and not feel like I need to interfere so much and try to fix everything. I'm married, and I have my wife has a son from a previous marriage. And when we got married, I was baffled as to what my role would be in this child's life, because he spends time with us and he spends time with his dad. And we had to seek some outside help and go to some counseling on it, because I was afraid that I would get too involved, you know. And we had professional help with it, because I didn't want to lose my mind over something that was none of my business, you know. I'm at a happy place with it today. I've reached this level of, like, I know what my involvement level is, and I'm not, and I don't have to interfere with his life, and I don't have to interfere with their life. And it's just an amazing thing when it's amazing for me to look back on where I was when I first came in here and look back on it in the last few years and be like, just see the progress. And I'm not taking credit for it, by the way. I should say, like, Alcoholics Anonymous is what led me to that solution. So I'll pass. Thanks.
Oh, man. Yeah. I love the part where it talks about most people try to live through self-propulsion, because really that was me, you know. I know a lot of people can relate to that, but I just would wake up in the morning and I felt like if I could just strap on my rocket blasters, like, I know what I want to do today, and I feel horrible, but if I just get over this hungover portion, which normally means a little bit of more of a drinking portion in the morning, and then I can get through, and I've got all these plans. And it was funny, because in the morning I'd have these plans, I'd be ready, and it's funny what, like, three or four beers will do to you first thing in the morning. You're like a little bit amped up, and then slowly but surely, I have done nothing, and I'm sitting on the couch, and, you know, half a dinner's cooked, and my husband comes home, and it's burning, and, you know, I have all these plans, and darn it, I'm going to do them all. I'm going to make everything happen. But what the problem is what's the most important to me is drinking. And if you get in the way of my drinking, then you're going to get out of my path one way or another. Whether it's me blowing you off with the rocket ship or the rocket blasters, you know, just pushing through you, or whether it's me, you know, running away, not coming home, you know, acting out. You know, I can say at 26 when I got sober, I probably had the mentality of, I don't know, a 15-year-old might be generous if you're a mature 15-year-old, but something around that age probably. And I really also identify with this idea of kind of a theatrical life, because I was a dramatic drunk. Like, everything was just this terrible, you know, oh my goodness, woe is me, someone needs to come take care of me. That was my thing. Like, I was a victim, and when I drank, I needed someone to care for me. That was really the problem. It's the husband. He's not letting me drink the way I want to drink. And when we met, he used to like to drink like me, but now he's all mature and an adult and a parent. Like, what is this? So, you know, I identify with that. And especially going back to the theme of unmanageability and control, if you made me mad or if there was something important that I needed to say, you better believe that I have had that conversation with you at least 10 times in my head before I've even looked at you. I've thought of each word I'm going to use. I've thought of the dramatic effect that it's going to have on you. I've thought of the way I'm going to look at you when I say it, and I've thought of what you're going to say back to me, and then how I'm going to respond. Or in the alternative, if you say this, then I'm going to say this. And, you know, it is an exhausting existence. To be honest, you know, they have those commercials about distracted driving and texting. My distracted driving is sitting in the car, zoning out, thinking about who I'm going to go see and how it's all going to go down. The whole thing has already been played out before I get there. And if it doesn't go the way that I want it to go, you better believe I'm replaying it in my mind when I get home to figure out what went wrong and where, oh, I was supposed to say that you were a liar right then, but instead I said, maybe you shouldn't have said the word that you said that one time. You know, I have to analyze it and overanalyze it, because in my head, if I can just think hard enough about it, then I can solve it and I can fix it, you know? And that's, for me, self-propulsion too. If I just funnel as much brain power into whatever issue I'm going through, then one way or another, it's gonna get resolved. The problem with that is that gets me drunk 10 out of 10 times. And the other problem with that is that's my mind. I have a mind that doesn't stop. And so I get myself drunk 10 out of 10 times with that kind of thinking, with the thinking that if I just funnel mental energy into a problem, then I can fix it, then I can control it. That's me taking the first drink already, you know, before I'm even at the store with the six pack in my hand. That's me getting ready to get drunk, you know. Jen and her ideas. Someone told me when I first came in the program that the problem is I need to do stuff. I have to plan my day. My sponsor lovingly told me that God's not going to fold my laundry. That made me kind of irritated. So I have to think and I have to do things. But what I want to do and what I absolutely can't do, what is a huge trap for me, is to think that I can control the outcome. You know, I can say I'm going to be a good person today. I'm going to read this book. I'm going to meet with my sponsor. I'm going to meet with my sponsee. And I'm going to follow through on those things, because those are promises and those are things that I've said I'm going to do. What I can't control is when it pours down raining or when my car breaks down halfway there, you know? And that's, for an alcoholic like me, that's the part that I desperately want to control. And that's what I had to learn to let go of in this program. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, the next reading is on page 61. What usually happens, the show doesn't go off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure that others are more to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is the basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker who, even when trying to be kind? Sorry, my bad. Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only he manages well? Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things that he wants? And do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all that they can get out of the show? Is he not, even in his best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony?
First, I just want to say I can really relate to Jen's imaginary conversations in her head. Like, I used to love to have those when I was walking my dog in the morning. I'd have these wonderful, drawn-out verbal battles with whoever my enemy was at the time. And, you know, I don't think any of those conversations ever took place. But they sounded great in my head. Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only he manages well? I heard this awesome speaker early in sobriety. We used to go to a group of guys that I got sober with up in Harrisonburg. We used to go to these men's retreats. Went to one in Roanoke, went to a few near Atlanta. And the speaker from, I think he was from Nashville, his name was Scott Lee. And, you know, he said that he was talking about how his sponsor was explaining the steps to him, and that basically he would always ask his sponsor, why do I have to do these things? And his sponsor said, why is a management question. You are no longer managing your life, so you do not get to ask the question why anymore, you know? And I always liked that take on things, you know, because, like, you know, when I came in here, I really had to be all out of the desire to manage my own life anymore, because I think that was what... I didn't get sober right away. I went to treatment when I was 19, you know, and then I had a couple more runouts, and it was always about managing, you know. I always wanted to jump in, take back over, and it never turned out well. I sponsored a guy for a number of years, probably about 10 years ago, and he was a great guy, and he loved his family, and he worked hard, and he would do the same thing, you know. He'd be all in, like, what do I need to do? What do I need to do? You know, and he knew, but he was asking, which is, like, a good thing to do, and we'd go to lots of meetings, and we'd get in the book together, and we'd hang out, and we'd go to workshops, and we'd just do all sorts of stuff together, and then he would reach about 3 months, maybe 4 months, and he jumped back into that management position, you know, and he died. He got hit by a car trying to cross the road drunk one night 7 or 8 years ago. And it was basically predictable. Like, I had to stop being a sponsor. I just had to say to him, like, I'm not the guy for you, man, because this is what's going to happen. And I would predict it, and he would do exactly those things, you know, 3 to 4 months, and then I wouldn't hear from him for a while, and then I'd get a call and he'd be in some other state or city, you know, not knowing how he got there. And, you know, and it was because he was trying to manage, you know. And for me, that gets me in trouble. For me, when I make the attempt to, and I've been doing it lately a lot, you know, in the morning on my knees, saying that third step prayer. I text all the guys I sponsor and the guys they sponsor. I text them out some, like, thought for the day from, I think as Bill sees it, is what I'm doing it from right now, you know, a little text message. And I'm not trying to manage well anymore. I'm trying to do what I know works because I've done it before, but if there's some questions that I don't know the answer to now, my first instinct isn't to just try to figure that out, you know. My first instinct now is to reach out to people in the program or to reach out to my sponsor or to pray about it, which is, like, I don't know, there's still some, like, rebellious part of me that doesn't want to pray about things. But, you know, old me when I was drinking, and I guess what the gist at the beginning of that reading we just did was all about was that idea of manipulating. And I love to manipulate. Like, that was just like it was like a running buddy of control, you know, like control the manipulation, man. They're hanging out together all the time. And, you know, if you like one, you're going to love the other. And I loved to manipulate, and I loved to be that person you wanted me to be so that you would do what I wanted you to do. I even did a lot of it in sobriety, under the guise of just trying to be like a nice guy. But the reality was that I just was trying, like I wanted people to like me. So I can remember like I wouldn't have any money, but I would like spend money on friends and stuff to like get them to respect me. I don't know what the motivation was. It was kind of sick thinking. It doesn't happen anymore. In fact, it's very freeing to tell somebody you can't do something because you don't have the money. They don't have a comeback to that. And there's really nothing they can say. Like, you know, when you're just honest, like, I don't have any money. They're like, oh, well, okay. You know, like, there's no getting around it. But, yeah, I hate when I manipulate now. I don't feel good about it. I still do it. I still get selfish. I still want my way sometimes. But it's a really it doesn't make me feel good about myself. You know, AA gave me a conscience, and AA gave me the ability to feel guilt and shame and remorse, and I can feel those things today, and they're real and they hurt, and I try to avoid them if I can. You know, and I'll still feel them, I try not to feel them at my own, you know, I try not to be the cause of my own bad feelings anymore. I'm happy to say I'm a fairly recovered manipulator. I'm not a perfect recovered manipulator, but I'm getting there, and I hope to keep progressing. Thanks.
I think for me, this part, is he not even in his best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony? When I read that for the first time, for some reason it really struck me. It kind of felt like daggers in my heart because that was it. Like, that was me. Really, in my best moments, I was a cyclone, you know, whirling through my house, sweeping up pretty much everyone in my path without regard to women, child, man, you know, elderly, whoever you were. If you were in my path, you were going to get it. And there's someone in my home group who's just an amazing person, and one of the things he'll say is that that he wasn't lying to himself, or it wasn't, I can't remember exactly now, I'm gonna ruin it, so but basically, if you lie to yourself, or if you're, you know, lying to yourself, then you know what the real from the false is. But I'm delusional, and that means if you hook me up to a truth or a lie detector and I tell you a lie, it's just gonna flatline. You know, there's not gonna be any noticeable, you know, physiological reaction, because I think I'm telling you the truth. And I'll be honest, guys, I thought I was a nice person. I really, really did, from the bottom of my heart. I knew that I was a bad wife. I knew I was not a stellar mom. I was not an available mom. But with my friends at the bar, you know, those people, I thought I was awesome, you know? Who wouldn't want to hang out with me? I'm really cool. But I really did think I was nice. The problem with that is, just being nice doesn't make you a nice person. And what I never knew was that underneath all like the sweetness or the, oh, sure, I'll pay for it, or, you know, oh, you need help with that? Sure, yeah, I've got that. Underneath all of that, I had motivations that weren't great. You know, it was, I need to feel better about me, and you're gonna be my vehicle to feeling better about me. You know, this has nothing to do with you. I don't want to help you. It's Saturday. It's 9 o'clock. I could care less about moving your stuff. But you know what? You're going to like me, and it's going to make me feel good. And that's something, like, that I was so to the core delusional when it came to thinking that I was a nice person because I did nice things. No. I was a manipulative person, and I did nice things so that I didn't have to face the truth about myself, which is that I don't care about you. I care about me. And I care about feeling good about myself. And the way I feel good about myself is through external validation. And if you're going to give me that, if you're going to pat me on the head and say, good job, Jen, you're doing a good job, you know, then perfect. You know, we're made for each other. And that is something that, you know, I know we're not there yet, but my fourth step was just like littered with that. It was like, need to be loved, need people to tell you you're good, can't do anything without feeling like you're not good enough. And it was just, I mean, it was almost boring because it was just all the same thing. But yeah, I mean, I was delusional because I for the life of me had no idea that my motivations were not what I thought they were. And so today, even when I do stuff, and like Adam said, I now have this thing called a conscience, and sometimes it feels guilty. And what I want to do is, when I feel guilty about something, is run to the person and tell them, like, basically word vomit, like, I'm so sorry I did this, 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 this. And I can't always do that. You know, I'll have to call my sponsor and she'll be like, what's your motivation? Is it because you really genuinely think you owe them some kind of an amends, or is it because you want to feel good? Is it because you feel like you did something wrong and you're going to feel better once you tell them? And man, it stinks to have to sit there and think about that, but I really truly believe that checking my motivations is probably one of the most important things that I've learned in recovery, because I never knew that there were layers to the reasons that I did things, you know. So, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. The next reading is on page 62. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it can kill us. God makes that possible, and there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them, though we would have liked to. Nor could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help.
This is the part of the big book that scared me early on, because I'm like, oh, this is when they start bringing God in, and here we go, and, you know, swinging, smoking things are going to come out, and, you know, there's going to be, like, hoods and robes, and, like, I remember sitting in rehab and, like, saying something out loud, and everyone had this weird reaction, which I now recognize was probably, like, disgust, or, like, oh, what a fool, but I remember saying something like, oh, this AA thing sounds great, but we're just going to have to leave all this God stuff out, because that ain't going to work in my life. And they all just kind of like, have you not been paying attention for the last, you know, 3 months that you've been here? But, yeah, man, I was like, I was hoping to neatly evade the God question. That was my goal in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did what you guys told me to do, and I don't, you know, they talk about that door of willingness, you know, just needing to be cracked, just cracked, you know, like, I left that thing cracked for, like, several years early on in AA. I did steps, I had a sponsor who said, can you believe that the third step, that God's will for you is to at least move on to the fourth step, and I said, okay, I can buy that, and he said, all right, well, let's move on, you know, and I wasn't like an atheist or anything, I don't even know, I wasn't any of these things that are identifiable by words. I just didn't think about God, and I didn't want to start thinking about God when I came into AA either. You know, I was like, oh, we'll just, I don't want to deal with this right now. But y'all made it pretty clear that if I wanted to stay sober, that I would probably have to at some point form a relationship with a higher power. So I did pray on my knees, and anyways, getting back to this paragraph, you know, there's some fairly absolute statements in here. You know, they say there's no must in Alcoholics Anonymous, but yet here's one right here, right? We have to get rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us, you know, and I love statements like that in the book. I don't like statements that have wiggle room in them, because I will find a way out, or find a way to do the easiest possible aspect of that, whatever they're telling me to do. This is where, when I started working with a sponsor when I was about, I'd had sponsors before, but this one guy, I was maybe about like 3 years sober, 2.5 years sober, and I lived up in Richmond at the time, and he used to have me go home and read pages 60 to the bottom of 63, and he's like, I want you to read it every day, I want you to read it every day, I want you to read it every day, and you know, he really got me zeroed in on third step and how important it was to my sobriety. And well, I really love the next paragraph, but I'll stick to this paragraph. But you know, I can totally relate to having moral and philosophical convictions. Like Jen was saying, I believed I was a nice person, and I was, until it came time for, you know, that itch to be scratched, you know, which was getting some booze. And then I didn't care how many people I hurt. I didn't care what I had to say to you, lie to you, steal from you. It didn't matter. Like, I was talking to somebody one time, and I was saying how, like, if I'd ranked up everything in my life numerically when I was drinking, obviously drinking would have been number one. But to call something else number two and then number three and four isn't really accurate, because it sort of, it depicts like there was an even interval between one and two and three and four, when the reality was is that like drinking was like number one, and then it started at like number like 900, 901, 902. You know, like there was such a drop off about things that I cared about when alcohol was involved. And yeah, those moral and philosophical convictions, they were all part of that. Yeah, I was a good guy until, you know, and that was probably what people would have said about me. He's a good guy when he's not drinking. Or he's a good guy on Sunday afternoons from like 3 to 5, you know, or something like that. But I so wanted to be able to get rid of all this stuff on my own power. I so wanted to just be a problem drinker that could just stop and get better. I say this lovingly, but I would love to be sitting at home right now and not in an AA meeting and just be a problem drinker, just, you know, eating dinner with my family or watching something on Netflix or, you know, whatever. But that's just not my experience, you know. I stopped drinking, my life got worse. Everything I tried to come at with my willpower seemed to get worse as well. And I think that's what separates me from the problem drinker. Thanks.
Yeah, so for me, step three really came down to being desperate. You know, when I first came in here, I was in and out of the program for a good year before I was really, you know, sold, before you guys sold me on this program, you know, because it's all about me. The problem that I had was I really felt like I needed this burning bush moment, you know. I understood that this was a spiritual program, but what I didn't understand was that that doesn't mean that I'm going to come in here and have this, what do they call it, dramatic upheaval. And so finally, someone took me through the appendix on the spiritual experience, and that was kind of life-changing for me. That coupled with someone pointing out to me that the 12th step says that having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, it kind of gave me that peace of mind that I needed, that, okay, I'm not completely screwed if I don't have this dramatic spiritual experience right now. Like, if God doesn't come and reveal himself to me at this very moment, that doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to get drunk. Because that's kind of what I thought. I thought that, you know, you guys were all super spiritual. You came in here and you were struck spiritual, and that wasn't happening for me. I still had some reservations, and you know, what am I supposed to do? I guess I'll just get drunk. And that stopped working for me when I got desperate. When the delusion that I could drink like others, or might one day be able to drink like others, was completely smashed, I didn't care anymore. You know, I will, you know, do whatever you tell me. I will get on my knees in the middle of a coffee shop and feel like the eyes of everyone in the world are staring at me, and pray with you, and I'll do whatever you ask me. Just take this away from me, because the pain was too much at that point. So for me, it really was the fact that I had to be desperate. I had to be desperate enough to be willing to say that, yes, I can say that I am not the Alpha and the Omega. Like, I know that 100% for sure. And from there, it just kind of went on. I just kind of grew, and I'm still not. You know, some days I wake up and I don't even, you know, my brain's already somewhere else. It's already halfway through my day. And generally on those days, things just fall apart, and I'm like, what's going on? Why is everything falling apart? Oh yeah, because I didn't pray. I didn't think about anyone else. For me, one of the best exercises, I think, one of the ways that I really became kind of tuned in to the idea of spirituality was thinking about how can I be helpful to someone else today? Because I promise you, like, every time that something was going wrong and my sponsor said, hey, how about you pray and ask God to show you someone you can be helpful to today? Someone would pop up in my life. And there's been things that I can't explain, you know, that have happened in my life. And the reality of it is today, I don't feel the need to, and this is kind of life-changing for me. I don't feel the need to overanalyze it. Like, I don't feel like I have to understand this completely, and I don't feel like I have to be perfect at spirituality, because I don't think you can be, first of all. And second of all, or at least I can't be, let me take that back, I know that I cannot be a perfectly spiritual person at all times. It's just not in my DNA. I mean, I just can't. I'm still a selfish human being, you know? But I can grow. And I love that the book gives us this baseline of progress and not perfection, because left to my own devices, I'm a black or white, all or nothing, good or bad person. I'm either gonna be perfect or I'm gonna fail at it. If I can't be perfect at it, then I'm gonna be perfectly horrible at it. And that's just who I am, you know? And I have learned to be okay with the gray area, especially when it comes to my spirituality, because that's a life or death errand for me. If I'm gonna turn it into this dichotomy of I gotta be perfect or I'm nothing, then I'm gonna drink, because I can't be perfect. So for me, being able to be okay with, hey, I'm a work in progress. Spiritually, I'm a work in progress. That is life-changing for me. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing. All right, I'm going to read the last two paragraphs and let you guys finish up. The first one is found on page 62. This is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we had to decide that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal, we are his agents. He is the father, we are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was a keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. And then the next is on page 63. It says, we were now at step three. Many of us said to our Maker, as we understood him, God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them would bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready and that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him.
I like simple statements in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And like when it says, first of all, we had to quit playing God, it didn't work. Like, that was just like a great thing for me to read. I always read the bottom part of that. This may not resonate with all of you guys, but for those of you that grew up maybe playing video games, Like, I remember growing up and playing, like, early Nintendo, stuff like that, and, like, you would reach certain points on video games where, like, if you died after that point, you didn't have to start all the way back over at the beginning. You would start at that point, and it was always a big deal to get there, you know? And so I always looked at the third step, and this new and triumphant arch through which I'm passing is, like, that was a point for me, you know? Like, and once I got there, like, I felt like I didn't have to... Like, I wasn't going to have to go back and start all over. Like, I'd reached, like, a safe spot to continue on from, even if I was, like, struggling with, the fourth step or the fifth step. I could always just come back and kind of get back on this third step thing and figure out, like, what am I missing here? What am I not willing to do? And we skipped one of my favorite paragraphs in the big book, so I'll touch on it for a quick second. It's not your fault. Don't worry. No one knew it was one of my favorite paragraphs. My sponsor in Richmond, Gary B, who was he was like one of the most like selfless people I ever met in my entire life. Still to this day, I mean, like an amazing guy. I think it talks about in maybe The Family Afterward how like some alcoholics just they don't get married, they don't have kids, but they're just able to like really give themselves to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was that, like, he was that, like, perfect picture of it. And but he was the one who had me reading this section of the book over and over again. And, he used to always say to me, Adam, the most important statement in the big book is that being all powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. And I was like, okay, and I was like, all right, whatever. I didn't really understand much. He would ask me, like good sponsors do, like ask questions where you just know as a sponsor you're going to get it wrong. And like your sponsor kind of wants you to miss it, but he was like, what do you think God's work is for you? And I said, I don't know, stay sober. And he's like, basically that he got to the point where he was like, no, God's work is for you to be of service to other alcoholics. That's it. He said, if you do that, everything else will take care of itself. And he believed that. And I can't say I believe it as wholeheartedly as he did, but I do believe it. You know, like when my life is sobriety centered, God centered, thinking about others in the program, it's funny how things just kind of take care of themselves. And I said, well, what about all this other stuff? What about, like, staying sober? And what about, like, getting a job or having a family? And he said, those are all great things. He said, and in fact, you might have all those things happen. He said, but those are just byproducts of helping that still suffering alcoholic. He said, if that's the thing that you do, he's like, everything else will happen. And and in my life, anyways, he's been right, my journey in sobriety right now is... I don't have time to go to tons of meetings all the time. I have two young kids. I've started a new career. I'm just busy. But I sponsor four guys, and I'm in touch with them all the time. And they come to my house. And guys that they sponsor call me and text me. And guys that they sponsor call me and text me. I get to try to perform my higher power's work well. Some days better than others, but it's amazing. I had a sponsor real early on, and it wasn't really third step related, but whenever I'd call him up and I'd say like, oh man, I got all this stuff happening, and he'd go, all right, I want you to hang up the phone and call three other alcoholics and ask them how their day's going. And I would, and I finally figured out what he was doing, which was he was getting me out of myself. Ask other people what's going on in their lives. Or as I've heard other people say, if we all took our problems and threw them in the middle of the room, we'd all be chasing after our own problems. We wouldn't want to have anybody else's problems, Like, my problems today are pretty awesome problems to have, When I'm praying, I feel... I don't know if this will come out right, but maybe somebody can relate to it. When I'm praying regularly, which I do now... I feel like a fraud when I'm acting like a piece of garbage. I should probably just like not act like a piece of garbage, like that would probably be the right thing to do. But like, I still have this like part of me that wants to misbehave or do bad things or go to dark places. And it's harder for me to do those things when I'm actively engaged with a higher power, when I'm trying to be spiritual, when I'm like talking about God in front of a room of people. You know what I mean? Like, it's more difficult for me when I leave here tonight to lay on the horn behind somebody or ride someone's ass or whatever. You know, it's much more difficult. And I'm okay with that. Like, I like that. I'm okay with it. But anyways, you know, I love the third step now. I think that my experience when I did it the first time, I'll wrap up with this. I did it in a chapel in the woods at like a 4-H camp with a bunch of guys. I didn't know what the third step prayer was. They just said, hey, we're going to go do the third step prayer. And I was like, all right, whatever that is, let's go do it. You know, and like all these guys were in this chapel. It was quiet. It was the morning before we were leaving this big men's retreat. And it was just really powerful to see, for a shallow guy like I was at that point in my life, to see other guys who I thought were cool on their knees praying was a very powerful experience for me. I don't care anymore about that sort of stuff, but at that moment, it was very powerful to see that. And that was my experience with the third step. Thanks, I'll pass.
Yeah, this prayer for me is really comforting. I think probably because it's the opposite of every foxhole prayer I ever said. You know, I have such a bad mental association with those, please God, like, I promise I'll never do blah, 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 blah again if you just do this for me. Like, if you just, you know, have my husband not file divorce papers, if you just, whatever, you know, get me out of this DUI somehow. Whatever the problem that I had was, you know, I would say the foxhole prayer, and then after things had settled down, like, okay, that was enough of that God stuff, you know. But for me, this, I really the idea of the bondage of self, I definitely get it. I get it because I was my own worst nightmare, and I felt completely hostage. Like, I felt like I took myself hostage plenty of times. Like, my own mind has taken me hostage. And even in sobriety, if you know, for me, I experience the bondage of self occasionally when I'm at a meeting and, you know, people are going around, it's open discussion, and it's all of a sudden, me, 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 what am I going to share? What am I going to say today? And actually, someone asked me what I was going to talk about tonight, and it's like, well, you know, I don't generally think about it anymore. I pray before, but I don't think actively, and now it's showing, but I don't actively think, hey, this is what I'm going to share about tonight, because when I do, I get mired in my own self, and I lose sight of what I need to share that's going to help someone else. I'll edit it, I'll cut out the parts that I don't think are very sexy, and I'll tell you the parts that make me sound kind of cool and dangerous and edgy, when really I'm just a huge nerd, and I really appreciated the checkpoints. Love it. Love the video game checkpoints. But yeah, so I mean, so I still get trapped in the bondage of self. And my favorite thing is, and I'll end with this, is I've experienced some things in sobriety that I kind of felt like, wow, this is what that prayer means. Take away my difficulties of victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. There was a girl who was in the PhD program with me at one point, and you know, I left and got sober after getting a DUI, and we had some of the same kind of issues going on. And 2 years, or maybe 2 years into my sobriety, she called me. She's like, hey, I know we haven't talked for a while. I just got a DUI. I really need your help. I got a problem. And I was able, I mean, I, same thing, like same kind of point in life, same, you know, just these things that I had already experienced, that even something so simple as, hey, here's an attorney that I know is a good guy, and just that you know, I left the program because I'm an alcoholic, and if you think that you might be interested in going to a meeting, or if you think, you know, if you want to talk more about what's going on, I can talk with you if you'd like. And I ended up sponsoring her for a while, and just that experience and just seeing how, hey, like, that was a really kind of, not saying that I'm like the only person that's ever gone to school, but just saying like that was kind of a weird, unique set of facts that her and I just seemed to kind of like pair off. And I had already gone through it. And so then I could take that experience and say, hey, look, you can get through it. Like, it's going to be okay. So with that, I would like to thank everyone here at Simple Actions for letting me share. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Everybody, let's stand up. We're going to pass the Seven Tradition basket at this point. Seven Tradition states every AA group ought to be self-supporting, fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, while contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses. The Seven Tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of your contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Are there any AA announcements?
Hi, Brittany.
All right, also we have some literature over here. I know there's harmonies over here, so they usually have some stuff posted in the harmonies of local stuff going on. The stuff you can fold, you can take for free. The stuff you can't fold inside has a price on it, and you can get with one of the home group members. So on that, Simple Actions is a home group. Nice segue. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, raise your hands. Newcomers, is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? Just raise your hand and introduce yourself. We're just here to say hi. Go ahead, sir.
My name is Robert, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Robert, welcome.
Greg, alcoholic.
Hey, Greg, welcome.
Greg.
I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Welcome.
All right, I kind of already did the literature thing. See a home group member if you're interested in purchasing some literature. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Anybody willing to raise, are we doing that? Okay. Anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. If you have a question or would like this additional information about sponsorship in AA, Kendra, you can come see me and I'll be available after the meeting. Please feel free to come talk to me. Reminders, smokers, please use the butt can provided outside. Stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. And again, can we thank the panel for sharing?
I'm clapping for you, not for me.
All right, thanks all who participated. After we clean up, you are all invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol. Okay, which is right down on Collier, right?
22nd and Colonial.
22nd Colonial, thanks, man. All right, do I have a volunteer to read the last two paragraphs on page 164? Go ahead, hon.
Alcohol. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answer will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right. The great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Deal with shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until you.
Thanks for reading.
Thank you.
Anybody who cares for the promise in the Lord's Prayer.
You did great. Yeah, good job. Well done.
Thank you.
I know, they did well. No run-ons. That's awesome. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Amen. Amen.